This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm not here speaking on behalf of anyone in any formal sense, but I think it's appropriate and fair for me to thank you also for those who are trying to address you through me and through these works, people who are not present. I'll name in particular three individuals whose cinematographic work is key to some of the works here, Darren Munenge, Prosper Nkuba, and Rogers Bekani Mumpande, but also Sarah Muchimbe. These are people who address you, as I said, through the works that you will encounter here this evening. I'm especially grateful that Susan Mizellis is here to join me. We're going to have a conversation as though we were in a living room and as though our living rooms had chairs with no backs. We have not pre-planned this, but it's an incredible honor for me to be here with Susan, not simply because she is the renowned photographer and documentarist that you all know about, but because she's a very important person. I don't even know if she knows this. In my own life, seeing her work, her photographic work on the Nicaraguan Revolution was a formative moment in my own politicization, reached out to me from across a vast geographical space, time, generation, language. At that point, I was a student in Canada. Mm. And I was moved by that photography, which led me to want to understand more. I became actively involved in solidarity movements in Vancouver. But it was, I think, in some very important way, Susan, who, unbeknownst to her, made me believe that one can accomplish certain kinds of, or produce certain kinds of connection in and through photographic and documentary work. Mm-hmm. And so this is, I'm not only an admirer of her work, but it has personally moved me greatly. And so this is a really great pleasure. And of course,
I just wish I could be in Rosalind's class at Columbia and go back. And then, go back in time in that formative period for myself, too. Because I've heard of Rosalind as a teacher, but we've never had this privilege. So thank you for letting us have a conversation with you and around you and around this work.
And around this work. So maybe it will help me, or help you, may help me too, to just provide a little bit of a context for the work that some of you have read a little bit about, if you've had an opportunity to read the wall text as you enter this exhibition space. As Erin mentioned, I have been working as an anthropologist in and around the gold mines of South Africa and the Witwatersrand for more than two decades. That world is a transforming world. During that period, it has moved from what was then the center and the kind of pinnacle of deep industrial mining to the space that is documented here, a space of ruin, of ruination. It's true, of course, that all mining is in some ways ruinous of the worlds, the natural environment, but also the social worlds that it sucks into itself. But these are mines in ruin in a very distinct way. The gold mines of South Africa are the deepest in the world. Some of these mines are 4 kilometers below the surface of the earth, and they are comprised of tunnels that stretch tens, twenties, indeed more than 100 kilometers laterally. So this is a world fabricated by industrial technology that is unthinkable in the absence of industrial technology, but also the forms of finance capital that make that technological kind of mining possible and that are central to the world that we all inhabit. So sometimes anthropologists appear to be the, the archivists of highly local and non-generalizable experience. And my first claim for this project, or the first claim that it makes upon you, is that you recognize that this is also your story. We all inhabit the world that is in produced in and by world money, global money, the forms of finance that arose out of and that were produced in and through the gold mining industry in South Africa. We all have gold in our cell phones. We are all in some ways entangled. I am personally more entangled, perhaps in a more immediate way. We can talk about that. But The work in this installation is a documentary record and a set of conversations and a set of addresses to the experience of those who in some ways were excluded even from that exclusionary industry during its heyday. So, as I said, these mines are in the process of closing and deindustrializing. The mines that you are seeing documented here, in fact, began to close in 1994, in the very moment that South Africa achieved its independence. That is, the moment of freedom was the moment of loss for many people. For some people living in this world, that contradiction, that freedom, and the loss of economic opportunity should be simultaneous is the greatest enigma of their time. Historians who anticipated the future closure of the mines suggested as early as the 1970s that the one thing that South Africa should try to avoid if it could escape the burdens of apartheid was a kind of nationalism without nationalization that would mean that the migrants who had previously been required to move to these mines to generate the values there would be excluded from the benefits of decolonization. And alas, that is what has happened. So the world of these mines is the world of illegalized migrant labor, undocumented migrants. Most of the people who work as scavengers in these mines come from Zimbabwe, Lesotho, Mozambique. They come in pursuit of hard cash, hard currency, the means to settle debts, to access the objects of their desire. They do so at enormous risk to themselves. Part of the project here is to make visible the nature of those risks. Part of the ambition here is to make visible the nature of the desire that mobilizes people to make these journeys. Part of the project here is to make us feel the complex webs that already bind us to this world, but that are otherwise not necessarily palpable or obvious in our ordinary lives. There's so much to say about this world, and so much, I think, leads one to want to reduce it all to a kind of political economy, and that's very important. But what this show is an exploration of, and a kind of a tentative, provisional exploration of, is the possible forms through which understandings gained in deep, long-term research can be shared with people who perhaps are not otherwise familiar with it. I have been involved in making a kind of relatively straight documentary film about this world, one that is driven by the needs of people to find a form in which they could recognize themselves. Part of that documentary project aims to make an intervention in the South African public sphere, where these illegalized foreign migrants are treated extremely badly, where they are the object of stereotype and xenophobic violence. And part of the ambition of a show like this, and part of the reason why I'm so grateful for the opportunity of a show like this, is to find out in what ways we can learn how to listen to people who indeed are addressing us, who solicit us, who ask for our attention, and whom we otherwise don't have the means to hear. So I'm going to just stop there for now and allow Susan to make sense of my meandering.
No, that was fantastic. I'm sure all of you appreciate it, because of course there are going to be many, many, many aspects of this to go back forwards, go forwards and backwards. I mean, the one thing just in your introduction as anthropologist / artist, and I was thinking about the distance between those two and not always, you know, more normally or more often separated. And I was thinking also about you as a writer, a critical writer, moving into space, moving from two-dimensional rendering of all that you've researched and experienced, and the difference of working in a space. And I'm sure there's a lot of consideration, and since some of the audiences maybe not had that much time, but I want to give you the opportunity to talk about that difference, because there is I am not a writer, so I'm always in space, and I was thinking about the difference of starting with space to render it, or starting with words translated into visuality, and then creating space for an audience. And so maybe That's one place I'd like to hear your thinking about, because there must be different parts of you that start to activate when you're writing, integrating, versus visualizing.
Yeah, there are different things that are possible in different media forms. You can undertake certain kinds of abstraction and analysis in a writerly mode that you can't necessarily achieve or not immediately achieve, or that require different forms in a cinematic mode. You know, this show is organized thanks to the space that is actually given to us by Slot, which is a fantastic space for the purposes of this show. So it's a hope that you enter this show through that main room and that you encounter this ambient piece, which is playing on a loop, stop, limit. Stop, limit is a concept that we get from finance, but it is also, to me, a beautiful metaphor for the experience of the border. And that piece should take you from the border, indeed the Limpopo border, where Zimbabweans cross illegally into South Africa. And that piece should take you via all of those forms of transportation that will take these miners to, first of all, that golden city, Egoli, city of gold, Johannesburg, where everyone imagines that, indeed, opportunity resides. And it's a gorgeous, you know, drone shot of a beautiful city with the sun rising upon it. And you move from there to what are, you know, what is the abandoned mind? You see the abandoned headgear. It should move you into this space. And you should pass through that door, on either side of which you have still images from that piece, Stop, Limit, one of which called Shadowland is a drone shot. And if you look at that image, you will see this is an informal settlement in the area of these mines, where most shacks are approximately, let's say, 6 by 10 feet wide. This is a residential dwelling for maybe 4 people. But you will see that in the streets between those shacks, there are shadows. And those shadows over are people, and you can see a dog sitting that is being responded to by a person. So much emerges from those in-between spaces. Mm. And that should be, if it works, a kind of a guide to the way that you might read the other works in this show. Mm. On the other side of that, you have another image from Stop Limit, which has the image of a combi bus, the mode of transportation by which most people make this journey, having usually paid smugglers, Malaitchas, our version of South African version of the coyotes.
Right.
And my sense is you probably see first this screen there, a screen called No Accident, which is, of course, the narration of an accident, which is the consequence of this journey. And a man in that narrative tells you something. He describes an accident, and at some point he says, after having encountered the heat, he says, "I saw a leg, and I didn't know if it was mine." And this line is such a, should be, to me it was, such a shocking thing to hear, as he narrates this incomprehensibility of his own experience. So this consequence then opens onto the other images. These are all images taken from the videos. They are not photographs. Yeah. They are not set up as photographs. Yeah. They are captured from image tracks in movement. The images on the far wall are underground. And by the time you are moving through the world above ground on this screen, if you turn around from the account of a man in an accident, you hear the stories of a woman named Sarah Muchimba, who tells you the experience of women who are both afraid of what might befall them and who know what befalls them as laborers crushing rock by hand and yet do it anyways. And the strangeness of the fear of the possible arrival of violence and the willing, if one can say willing, submission to the violence, slow violence of crushing rocks is one thing. And this same woman, if you recognize, it is the same woman 2 years later who is speaking now with her husband, almost unrecognizable, so aged has she become, speaking with her husband about their hopes for education for their child, and also revealing what is surely a painful desire, the desire for documents. Yeah, the desire as an undocumented migrant to have documents. And it's part of this strange project to which all these people submitted, they want self-documentation. They want recognition mm-hmm. both by the state and by you and by me, mm-hmm. by the anthropologist mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. The loveliness of slot space means that you can move from here past this piece, which in which you encounter the kinds of metaphysical discourses within which people mine, both Christological service, which is very important in this mm-hmm. world, and the offering to ancestors is a translation of that prayer here, mm-hmm. which takes you into this more immersive encounter with the labor, the physical labor of that activity. Mm-hmm. And finally, the peace. I know I'm going mm-hmm. on at great length.
Well, I'm just like losing all the questions I have along the way. But that's okay. It's okay. We'll come back.
And finally, the piece in here, a film is being made from the outtakes of this filmmaking project where you hear these young men talking about what they think is happening when they are making a film. I taught them to make to use these cameras, but wow, did they acquire an incredible language, a cinematic virtuosity. Mm. You can see them deciding, do we need two cameras for this shot? Mm. That's a great scene. Let's get extra light here. We need to do this. You need to fake that. All that stuff,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Okay, you just got a whirlwind tour. I don't know where you want to go back to in this conversation, but, you know, again, I don't know what happens when you face a white page and you're going to start typing all the things that you've learned and researched and considered and outlined for a reader, and how you face this white space, which is where we all begin with the same walls fixed, and you have to reconfigure the experience, and you just... I think we just got the guided tour. Some of you will probably go back and maybe experience it in a different way because of the way Rosalind just walked us through. I saw some of these clips as clips at the end of an email. It's a completely different experience of the work, which is interesting to think of. So I came maybe 20 minutes before or a half hour trying to make sense of how they faced off and how the space actually functions. So choices like... that I think are very important to talk about are, I mean, where our practice also differs is that I would make a still photograph and make videos to intersect and expand the boundaries of the frame that's limited by the still. Yeah. And you're taking stills out of the video. So that in itself was intriguing to me. And then you're also quite strikingly directing, or the cameraman is, I don't know what the relationship was between the, you collaborated, but to what extent he determined the frame, but you're doing a very specific thing that I hope people will take note of, which is you're making a still frame in the video and allowing people to talk to each other, which is not generally the way in which filmmakers make the films that they make, mm-hmm. because they're usually intervening, extrapolating, directing.
Right.
And so it's a very specific camera, especially on
true.
In both of these, mm-hmm. the women and the report of accident, the camera is respectfully listening, and thereby we do. And that, I think, is really quite an important choice. And again, I don't know, maybe you can tell us how you figured out who you were going to work with on this project, which I know you have the minor collaborators, but also your own team. But just thinking about that and then how that functions, because you also had quoted, which I just read, but I absolutely love this expression that was so...
The little eyes of the ears. Oh, honey.
What an amazing... I don't know if you all got to that reading, but that idea is so deeply powerful. The eyes of the ears. The eyes of the ears. And so this work, whatever an audience will give you, and that's you're creating through the multiple platforms opportunities for different kinds of audiences, which I think is not what most visual artists have the capacity to do. They hope that a critic will come along and review the show and give a context mm-hmm. for their work that they may or may not understand fully themselves, that somebody else will elaborate in words because they create the experience. Some of you are practitioners, some of you are more theoretical, I don't know exactly, but so you're bridging and setting us up to both read and understand the reading, the textual elements and the visual elements in a very particular way for me, the way they complement. And particularly having gotten the email and seen the fragments without the right. contextual, I wasn't sure what I was seeing. So that's where space comes in, and this juxtaposition, and the positioning, and the way the stills reiterate what you've seen in the video, which is not what normally might be done. So I just want to accent that or underline that as a process that you've considered. And but go back to the eyes of the ears.
No, no,
because
no,
the eyes of the ears is such
that.
A beautiful phrase
it
that comes
beautiful.
From, I wrote Vilakazi, the guy's name down.
Benjamin Violet Vilakazi, great yeah. Zulu poet and novelist. Yeah. He wrote a very famous poem in called Izinkomponi on the mine compound, which is a kind of masterpiece of South African literature. But it comes from a novel of his, mm-hmm. a later novel. And indeed, he was describing how Zulu speakers first translated or how they first described the stethoscope, which was, of course, very important for the recruitment of early miners. Their lungs were tested both when they were recruited mm-hmm. and then periodically. And when their lungs were deemed no longer to be able to sustain them as miners, they were fired. So these little eyes of the ears were potentially malevolent. But initially, this exactly what you said, when I read that, I thought, ugh. This is
amazing.
I felt like it was waiting for me. I felt like it, or that I had tried to find a way to realize that idea. So hearing you say that thrills me to the bottom of my heart. I have to say, yes, my fundamental goal in all of this, or the kind of anthropology I do, is first of all, I'm moved by, interested in, I want to understand, I want to learn from people. Mm-hmm. And this takes place in the practice of dialogue, in the practice of conversation. So for me, video is a medium that can communicate that. I don't use it as a primary research tool myself. And I'm not an artist like you. I'm not a photographer like you. So what you have described, and particularly vis-a-vis these two pieces, I mean, my method for making the film is one in which we sit and talk for hours, sometimes days, about particular topics, is part of my learning, but also as part of their learning from me and about, in conversation you learn new things, right? When we're ready to film, they interview each other. Yeah, what is it that has arisen in that conversation that strikes them as being significant and that demands further exploration? At that point, myself, Ibrahim Haji, my beautiful cinematographer, and Musa Khedebe, an excellent, fantastic sound recordist, we're a teeny crew of three, had to be a small crew of three because it's a very dangerous and volatile area, and we had to be very mobile, but also because intimacy requires that you don't have 18 people and a food truck and all the rest, as little as possible. And then, indeed, Prosper Nkluba is the person who is interviewing his cousin, Bekani, and his wife, Sarah.
Right.
Fani Magwaza is interviewing these other men about the accident and so forth. So
I just want to underline again, so this is not cinema verite until you give the cameras to the miners who essentially are re-guiding themselves through the mines and talking and creating a dialogue with the space that they're in some ways, which is kind
of
amazing.
That's beautifully said,
But there's another... this idea, so I think we share in one sense this notion of immersion, the sense of listening, the sense of time. There's no rush. You're not trying to get something from them. And I think these are important aspects of what can happen in documentary, that practice can also be, what do I need?
Yeah.
My shot list, there are many ways, be it video or still photography, that can direct rather than listen to. So this directing versus listening.
Right.
So I have a very specific question. When you're doing the X numbers of hours or days, trying to figure out what is the story they want to tell and kind of interrogate themselves, do you record that? Do you document that at all? Do you take notes on it? Do you feel that it's going to help some other part of your practice down the line?
I mean, mostly I listen. I take notes after the fact. Sometimes we run cameras if those are around, but by and large, no. And I'm there all the time, or I'm there often, whereas Ibrahim is there for 3 days or 5 days or what have you. So he may come in after we've had these conversations. And, I mean, this is a nightmare for editing, needless to say. You know, over two years, every few months, go back, other things have changed. The conversations may go on for 4 hours. I translate with a team of translates absolutely everything and title it all before we even start editing. So I didn't, you know.
So you're listening, but you yourself can't understand fully.
I can understand some of it, but not all of it, because there are five languages being spoken here, and often sentences are three and four languages, and often people are speaking very broken versions even of their own languages.
So okay, so here's another little, you know, underline: trust.
Yeah,
trust. Incredible trust that you have in your cinematographer, your sound recordist.
Yeah,
they have. In those same people who don't come from the community, or they do? Do they come from actually, because some of these are Zimbabweans, but you feel this trust, again, of that frame, and maybe because the frame isn't activated, meaning there's only one or two where there's a zoom in, a zoom out, but I'm specifically talking about the kind of trust and the quiet that's established in those two pieces where people are talking about some difficult times.
It's true. I mean, I feel that's a kind of gift of both the extraordinary qualities of Ibrahim and Musa, who are extremely gentle, generous, thoughtful, and engaged artists, and with whom the people in this world, I wouldn't call it a community, it's a very transient world, people come and go, this week it's this group coming from that place, speaking this language, then it's another group. But the relations that we all were able to produce over the period of these years, I hope, I believe, were authentically indeed trusting. I mean, Ibrahim is a remarkable cinematographer. He can be, you know, this close to you with a camera, with a lens this big, and somehow people are at ease with that. I mean, he's so careful. And it's a very strange thing. I mean, you can't really describe that except as a quality of being. And and this extends in the relationships he has with me and them beyond the project. You know, we're all in communication all the time. Social, you know, whatever, WhatsApp, on the phone.
We have to get to the WhatsApp. We have to get, because I don't know how many of you have had the time to be in this room. But there is one line in this one that just totally blew me away. Let's get to that in a second. I just wanted to go also back to audience, because you all have been in this space. Some of you have maybe come back. Some of you have spent more time than others. And I always think it's a difficult question. You know, what, not just the audience you hope for, what they expect by collaborating, partnering with you, who do they imagine this being for? And also, to what extent, what we're talking about, this listening, how do you receive this work, you all? And maybe you can come back to us with some of the questions that you might have. But I think those are three different kinds of psychological expectations, you might say. I don't know how much they understand, because this is a key question about representation. No, they trust you. We're talking about the trust to produce, to make the work, to take the work away, even though they've seen aspects of the work, and then what they imagine is happening, which you get a little of in this room when they talk about, oh, my wife's cell phone, she's going to have a video clip on it in WhatsApp. And it completely blew my mind that that was what he was envisioning and so excited about, making what he was making in the bottom of the mine, so his wife's cell phone would have a clip. I mean, that's a psychological space I didn't expect. But begin with what you think. What do you think they were hoping for, and what what do you think audiences, how they listen, and what they take away, and what you're really hoping they can, you know, breathe this work, feel this work, when you talked about feeling this work.
So, I mean, of course, you know, what do people really want when they put themselves in this kind of sphere? They have kind of relatively short-term or relatively immediate aspirations, and those would be, I would say, of the order of exposure. They want to expose the police as among those who brutalize them, who demand bribes, who extract from them the fruit of their labor. So in a very immediate sense, that's what this man says he hopes
he's or hoping,
he believes.
Yeah.
He thinks that he's going to film a cop taking his rock from him and that this is going to circulate on the media and his wife somehow is going to be watching something on her cell phone because that's the primary means of seeing the news. And she's going to see her husband the cop, has robbed these young men, and she's going to say to him, why are you doing this? Why are you taking these poor men's hard-gotten goods? So there's exposure. There's also exposure that they wish, that they want addressed to the, as I said, the South African public sphere, where Zama Zama is the term. I mean, it's to use this word is to invoke specters of rapacious violence, extreme kinds of, thievery, but lawlessness, a kind of antisocial force. And what they want to expose is their own humanity in this context. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are not those people that we are said to be. Rather, we are the victims of those powers because we are not protected by the police, but in fact are preyed upon by them. So there's that level of exposure. Then there is, of course, what is always part of every anthropological kind of transferential relationship. There is that desire for recognition from someone who appears to be able to confer on you I won't say in a psychoanalytic sense confer on you a truth that you wish others would recognize, but a certain kind of recognition. But also a kind of affirmation, a kind of being touched by someone who can say, I see what you have gone through and so forth. There is, like there is among young people everywhere, an aspiration to be seen and to be known from afar, a kind of aspiration for celebrity. These are young people who live in the land of social media. They watch whatever, young people watch everywhere. They have aspirations to celebrity. And I think that's a complicated mix that I probably couldn't sort out myself. The intervention into the South African public sphere, which includes formal movements for decriminalization, the really immediate exposure of the brutality to which they're subject, and it's an extremely violent place. And then this other desire for recognition of so many complicated sorts, this is all at play. I mean, we spoke a little bit on the train and I said to you, maybe there are people in this audience who, like me, grew up in a mining town, like me, a granddaughter of a underground miner whose childhood has had the accompanying soundtrack of someone who can't breathe due to silicosis. And maybe they will hear or feel in that image of rock being crushed and then see it inhaled by women and think, there's something there that binds me, that has already bound me even before I see this image, and that is now revealed. I mean, there are moments that I hope that kind of traversal of otherwise seemingly vast chasms could take place. But there's also like me, the child of a mine manager who might ask about the ways in which we are all implicated in capital of this sort, and that would want to think about the obligations to respond to this history rather than the claims to represent it. The obligation to respond to a history that is already our burden, my burden. And maybe that could also open up conversations. I mean, here we are in Pennsylvania, the land of deindustrializing coal mining. I mean, does this have any way to speak to this story here, to the different ways in which deindustrialization takes place here and there? I don't know. I mean, my hope is that conversation could grow out of
that's
this.
That's the really challenging question. Well, for all of you, you'll hopefully think of ways you can share your responses with Rosalind, because that's something else you never get, or almost never get, is actually how does the work work? Who does it work on, and where do you take it beyond the experience of it in that moment?
Right.
How does it dwell? Does it lead you somewhere? Yeah. We were talking parallels of what I think is you can't not feel as you know, the exposure, the affirmation, but making more visible something that is so invisible to us. So whether you're wearing a gold ring, you know, or
you have a cell phone in which there's a little bit
exactly.
of gold. Or?
Yeah. So you have, you know, but we're so disconnected from the makers of with the things that have been made for us.
Yeah.
And so whatever it might be it the gold, the coal, the et cetera, the Bethlehem steel, the people who no longer get to make the things that we need, they're someplace else
right.
in the universe, and we're further and further disconnected from them. So I think that inevitably there must be some residue of that as people. I don't know whether or not the... It's interesting because even the first video when you're walking a long distance alone, just to start there, that's so uncommon for us.
Right.
That we have to, you know, and that wonderful way you talk about the mobility, the lack of mobility, though you have to be mobile.
Right, you have to move.
And you have to move. And how people move towards the opportunities that they seek.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that is kind of our condition now, this movement without mobility. Yeah, mobility would mean that you have the right to move and also the right to not be moved, if that was your choice.
Right.
Whereas people are having to move, but the question of the right to move and to not be moved if you choose not to be, this is,
right.
I mean, it's, you know, that border. So, I mean, we also talked about this on the train, you know, spectacle of this long, you know, we think that the U.S. border with its terrible fantasized wall is an exception. Alas, the Zimbabwe-South Africa border, as you see, is also a kind of triple barbed wire fence, but only for a certain distance, and that's close to the Bait Bridge crossing. But, of course, we were stopped by the police while we were filming along that border, and as I was anxious that we would be, and we were wished well, and it was hoped that our filming went well, and that we didn't lose anything en route. And I can't imagine that happening if I was on the U.S.-Mexico border and was found to be using a drone, for example. But but this, you know, the question of border, the question of movement without mobility, the predicament of deindustrialization, these are not only South African concerns.
Right.
But also one doesn't know how this stuff circulates. You know this more than anybody.
Yeah.
You who have generated images that have traveled so far.
Right, but I think more than the specific images that travel in this case, it's I think I'm interested in how it travels amongst us, you know. You know, what happens when we're in spaces like this. You also wrote a beautiful phrase. I mean, for me, something to think about, you know, the, of course, it's the not creating a false sense of being there. That's a very strong statement in the introduction. So photography, in a classic sense, photography used to be that intermediary where we could have the illusion that we've been somewhere because we've seen it. We do that on online all the time.
Right.
Right. Some people don't even bother to go places anymore because they think they've been there. Right?
And if you do go there, there's a place that tells you where to stand to photograph it so that people will believe that you were there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and in a way that's, I sort of made that connection just thinking about it with Eduardo Cadao, who many of you know because he's part of the magical circle around Slout. Couldn't be here with us tonight, but in a conversation with him, I found myself saying my body was my archive when we were back and forth. He was talking about trees and writing about trees. And this idea that you move yourself towards and stay or return, your body is the way in which you register who you are and what's important in so many different ways. But that this idea that you've been working for two decades in this arena, you know, this, I mean, narrowing down, I don't know how many other bodies of work have come from that period of time. Is this the one
enough.
Where, not enough? Is this the one that feels most kind of coherent in its accumulation of expression for you?
That's such an interesting question. I think of this as a provisional address. Yeah. I don't know what form it will take. I've done, for example, below ground, above ground has been projected in a large three-screen version, sort of trapezoidal, and which is more immersive. And nonetheless, I have insisted that that not be a kind of totally enclosed space because I don't want people to have the hallucinated sensation that it's like being in a mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, even I have been in this mind, but it even for me, I don't know what it is like to be in that mind in that way, in that exposed and vulnerable way. So, but you said something that's really important to me, which you said, you know, you take your body, it's your archive, you go, you return, you come back. I mean, that's a very important thing for these people there, that I do go back. In fact, that was the kind of first response to me was not, what are you doing here, but... Wow, you came back. No one's done that.
Though I think of that as in the training of anthropology. Long periods of time being somewhere and returning over time.
You'd think. yes, but this is maybe a slightly unusual space because it is not a community in any way. It's this transient, shifting space of wastage, really.
Right.
These are the rag pickers of this historical moment. So, but... immersion is important. This is not exactly not. I do not want anyone to have the sense that they are there.
Yeah.
What I would like is for people to feel the gap between the, I don't know, the sense of the intensity and the demands and the vulnerabilities that would be endured if one were there and the fact that one isn't.
Yeah, so that's that other sentence that I underlined. The gap between the viewing. And the acknowledgement of a lived life is different than the viewing of that life. So that's complicated because
when
you go into this little dark room, you are definitely not taking any risks like the miners, but you definitely, there's no question that you feel it because you're in that space, at least tentatively, associatively, psychologically. If you give yourself over at all, you feel the palpitations.
Right.
I mean, and of course, this is the big question for all of you. Can you give yourselves the space to feel the other in whatever form and through what means? I mean, that's the big question. How does the work work? Where's Aaron? He's supposed to be telling us. Are we supposed to...
Sorry.
Are we going to... Shall we
Aaron,
invite...
Aaron is,
do you want to respond to
that? Do I want to respond to
that? Yeah, okay. And then...
I mean... I think you said you kind of put it out in a way that leaves the demands of that open to all of us. It's not clear to me how one, at what point you give yourself over. I mean, these young men took those cameras. I trained them to use them. But what did that mean? That mean that we spoke for days about what they would do with those cameras underground. And that meant me telling them largely, don't save it all for the climactic event. Life underground, these people spend 3, 5, 7 days underground at a time. Sometimes weeks, sometimes months. This is a thing to think about, to be underground for months at a time.
It's unimaginable to every one of us, I am sure. Right? I mean, are we processing this together or are some of you asleep? I mean, that idea, I said to Rosalind on the train, I would be claustrophobic within about
three minutes,
I don't know how long I would last underground under these conditions. I have no idea, which I find very challenging even just to process yourself, you know. I mean, we know what happens when the city loses its lights, when we have a hurricane, when we lose power, we lose our cell phones, you know, we're... pretty inadequate at coping at that point. So,
you know, and they describe often their first experiences as ones that are terrifying. And sometimes people get lost, and many times people die or are injured and so forth. But, I mean, my basic point was that I suggested to them that, you know, when you live underground, then it is the fullness of your life that you want to document, not just the dynamiting, not just the strike of gold, if there is such a thing. Mm-hmm. And indeed, they did so. But far beyond, first of all, it terrified me, it horrified me to see that footage when it was first, when I first screened it. I mean, I couldn't believe I had gone down part way, but I had not gone to this extent. I did not know the full risks. I had asked them to wear body harnesses so that they would have hands free, knowing it would be dangerous. But they wanted to have those cameras in hand. Mm-hmm. And how quickly they generated a language, a conception mm-hmm. that they were making a film and that there was a narrative logic to this. Mm-hmm. There was an arc of activity they wanted to show. Mm-hmm. They were measuring the battery life of each camera.
I know.
Timing. You know, it's so many hours to this destination. We will still have to do this. Mm-hmm. We have to save one camera for when we get mm-hmm. above ground. Mm-hmm. We need two cameras for here. And, you know, it starts off, they're arguing about these matters. But within a day, they have produced a mm-hmm. collective language that is a gift to us mm-hmm. all. Mm-hmm. But it's also one of the reasons why you feel such mm-hmm. an intense encounter with the fullness of that space and all of its risks. They are showing you what they wanted you to see. And in that way, mm-hmm. it is their POV, you know, mm-hmm. truly.
Exactly.
It is not there, but it is their POV. One is always unsatisfied in some ways and always striving to achieve something in some ways. And it would be, of course, a disaster if one negated the other. If doing social justice work meant that you couldn't engage in representations, I would ask, how would that be possible? How could you undertake any address to the question of social justice without also engaging that of representation? But I would also, and I suspect you would agree, but you will tell me, that if one was only in the mode of display, if this world was simply coming to us as a kind of exhibition value, that this would perhaps be the negation of a more just response. And that would be disastrous. That would be wrong. Neither is this particular installation of my own one, you know, a complete undertaking. It's in relationship to others, and it's only one part of my engagement with that world. But I would want it also perhaps to provoke in people thoughts that could compel other kinds of activities. I mean, I'm not, you know, there isn't an NGO that you can go to and say, here, if you, you know, this group is working in this world to solve these problems. Mm. But there are, as we've just discussed, perhaps a myriad continuities and other related phenomena that could, that demand engagement, that deserve investment, that need creative attention. And my hope would be that that would lead to some thought about those other issues. But I do believe that solving problems creatively enables one to think creatively about problem solving socially. So I think learning to make works, learning mm-hmm. to write, mm-hmm. learning to mm-hmm. formulate, learning to represent does allow one also to develop the skills to engage questions in the real political world, as it were. I hope. But you might have a different answer.
Well, how could I possibly add to that? That was so just magnificently articulated. To me, it's, you know, the basic contradiction you live with when you make the work and hopefully represent the work and engage with audiences. And I think the whole conversation is we're asking those questions without the answers, but the attempts to engage in the question. Which, if you don't engage in the question, where are we? We have to move towards, and I just think you articulated that beautifully, so.
Okay,
thank you. It's a process. It's not a final form. We're all in process, in time, and we've shared this time together. So, thank you all.